This is MSCI Perspectives, bringing to light insights and analysis that help global investors tackle today's challenges. I'm your host, Adam Bass, and today is January 16th, 2025. Happy New Year! Regular listeners to the program know that each quarter we turn the microphone over to MSCI's Chief Research Officer, Ashley Lester. This time around, Ashley leads his panel of experts through a discussion on what may matter for investors this year. And a great companion to this episode is the latest paper on this subject called Investment Trends in Focus, Key Themes for 2025. And you can download that paper at MSCI.com. Here's Ashley's conversation.
Welcome to the MSCI Perspectives Quarterly Roundtable. We're back with our quarterly panel of MSCI experts discussing some of the largest questions in investment today. I'm Ashley Lester, the Chief Research Officer at MSCI and your host for today. Many people said that 2024 was going to be the year of geopolitics, and the fourth quarter certainly proved them right. The US, about 15% of the world's GDP and about 70% of its stock market cap, produced a big election result that looks set to overturn the economic and political playbooks of the past 50 years. All this at a time when the US has greater financial clout than virtually ever before. US stock markets are up, the US is the home of the private asset industry, and it's the home of the juggernaut that is artificial intelligence. Those of us sitting on the other side of the Atlantic are deeply aware of this apparent dominance. The Draghi report on European competitiveness last year called for a raft of reforms to European practices to increase the dynamism of the European economy. Meanwhile, judged by interest rates and stock prices, the financial and economic prospects of the world's other superpower, China, are not much brighter than those here in Europe. Last quarter's stimulus package for Chinese markets, if it hasn't quite sunk without a trace, certainly seems to be steaming towards the horizon under a thick cloud of dark smoke. So is this the moment when America is about to get even greater again? Or is it peak imperial hubris? Today, we'll start by digging into some of those exceptional American numbers, not just of the past year, but going into the more distant past as well. We'll discuss some possible directions for travel in 2025, including tariffs, interest rates, and volatility. When it comes to equities, we'll try to dig a little into just what it is that markets seem to be pricing in. We'll also discuss trends in electric vehicles and climate change, and we'll finish with some novel insights into the opaque worlds of private assets and real estate. But before we get started, I'll introduce our panelists. I'm joined today by Demetris Melis, MSCI's Head of Multi-Asset Investing Research, and Keith Crouch, a senior MSCI researcher on private assets. Also joining us today are a couple of our regular guests, Afsaneh Masturi, Head of Fixed Income Investing Research, and by Xinxin Wang, an expert on investment materiality of ESG. Welcome to the podcast, everyone.
Thank you, Ashley.
Let's start with getting some facts on American exceptionalism. Demetris, just how well did US equity markets do last year compared to the rest of the world?
They did exceptionally well, just to answer your question straight away. If we look just at calendar 2024, MSCI USA delivered a total return of about 25%, which is an extraordinary number. And then one way to understand the gap between US equities and the rest of the world is to look at other developed markets. And for that, our listeners can look at the performance of the MSCI IFI index. So the MSCI IFI index in 2024 only delivered a return of about 4%. And then emerging markets, the MSCI emerging markets index delivered a return of 8%. So obviously, you know, international markets, emerging markets, not a disaster. But on the other hand, the gap between US equities and other markets last year was truly huge. And, you know, this was not just last year. If we go back, as you mentioned in your introduction, maybe 5, 10, or actually 15 years, all the way back to the end of the global financial crisis, we see that in pretty much every rolling 3-year period, 5-year period, US equities outperformed international equities and emerging market equities quite substantially.
Is this just a fact about the world, Demetris? Is it just sort of foreordained that American capitalism is better for shareholders than any other form of capitalism?
Well, actually, it's not, because if someone was looking at the long-term equity market performance, let's say at around 2009, 2010, going all the way back to the late 60s or early 70s. By the way, MSCI has been calculating indices live for the last 55 or so years. So we have been calculating international equity indices since the late 60s, 1969. So looking back at the 70s and the 80s, actually you would have seen that international markets outperformed US equities most of the time. And then in the 90s and the 2000s, the early 2000s, it was actually emerging markets that were the darling of equity investors and outperformed most of that time. So, you know, the long-term history, certainly before the global financial crisis, doesn't actually indicate that US markets are a one-way bet, not at all. So that's what makes the last 10, 15 years even more extraordinary, in my view.
So let's zoom in. Now, you've said the last 10 or 15 years are extraordinary by that historical benchmark. But the last year where US markets are outperforming other developed markets by over 20% must be extraordinary even within that sort of context. Can you give us a bit more flavor or color for what happened last year? Is it just a bunch of tech stocks that are doing better in the US compared to everywhere else, but basically the markets are the same except for that?
It's not only tech stocks. So, you know, one way to think about performance is to also think about valuations. And nobody would be surprised to hear that after this extraordinary performance over the period 2009 up until now, when you look at valuation ratios, such as a simple trailing price to earnings ratio, of course, our models and analytics can provide our listeners with much more sophisticated ways of looking at valuations. But even simply looking at just a trailing price to earnings ratio, US equities are trading at much higher multiples compared to international and emerging market equities. Just to give our listeners some numbers, trailing PE for US equities is 28 times at the moment. It was about 25 times a year ago. So obviously, we've had some, even though even 25 times is a relatively high multiple, we've had multiple expansion for US equities in the last year. And then just to put that into context, emerging market equities are actually trading at a PE multiple, simple trailing PE of 16 times versus 28. And then IFI, international developed markets, only 15 times. So relatively speaking, both emerging markets, but also other developed markets, trade at much lower valuation multiples compared to US equities.
Wow, that's a massive valuation gap on that simple multiple, kind of a factor nearly of two. What about when we look across sectors or across factors? What does that tell us about US markets compared to the rest?
Well, actually, you're raising a very important point, because this lack of balance in equity markets does not manifest itself only on the country or regional dimension. When you look at the GICS sectors, the different sectors in equity markets, again, you see the dominance of information technology, communication services in particular. It's actually, I think, an interesting observation that if you think about these dominant mega caps in the US, the so-called Magnificent Seven or Mag Seven, not all of them belong to the information technology sector. It's only three out of the seven that are actually traditional technology companies. You have Apple, Microsoft, and Nvidia, but then you also have two of them belong in communication services. And therefore, from a sector perspective, the lack of balance is not as visible as it is when you look at regional and country numbers, but it's still there. And it's quite big, right? For the last year or so, technology communication services outperformed the rest of the equity market by a large margin.
Are some of those effects behind figure that I know we've produced within MSCI Research that shows that within sector, every GICS sector in the US outperformed its counterpart in that sector in IFI and emerging markets?
That's right. So actually in our investment trends paper, we have some analysis there that shows that, yes, you have US dominant, but that was not only driven by technology or communication services companies. If you look at other sectors, energy, materials, financials, and the rest, the US has outperformed other markets as well. So, yes, a lot of the performance is driven by the Mag 7, but it's not only the technology companies that contributed to last year's outperformance of US equities.
How has this shown up, Afsane, if I can bring you in? How has this shown up in other markets, such as rates or currency, over the course of 2024?
Certainly, there was a lot of conversation that we had about the equity and allure of the equity, what one element that makes them even more interesting for investors is the currency element into this. The the dominance of the dollar, even though large number of the investors across the different asset classes tend to hedge their currency position to avoid unintended risk or unintended downside upside either way. But what we have seen is that the post-COVID, the dominance of the dollar, the fast recovery of the dollar, and then the effect of monetary policy on dollar resulted in upside in investing in U.S. assets, simply one element of that being because of the dollar. The other feature of the market that we have observed, I would like to play the difference between U.S. and the rest of the world a little bit different than equities and its fixed income, because necessarily if we have an economy that is at the high employment, so it's saturated employment and the stable growth, we would not necessarily see that the fixed income is going to be the best asset in terms of the total return that they offer compared to the equity, which is based on the growth and looks into discount the positive perspective of the economy. But what we have seen in US playing, looking at the rate side of it, was that we came to end of 2023 to 2024 with the expectations that the high level of interest rate potentially would impact some sectors of economy. We observed at the beginning of the year some softness in some part of the labor market, and there were some expectations that high level of the rate can impact growth in micro level, especially on sectors that they are rate dependent, and would result in the normalization of the central bank policy. We had this conversation earlier this year as well, that actually what we would observe is that there were some scope for bringing interest rate lower because of inflation was basically coming down quite steadily. There was a scope for interest rate to come lower to be aligned with growth, basically the level of the rate to be aligned with the expectation for inflation and expectation with growth, i.e. the terminal rate around 4%. This is what basically central bank has done. But looking forward, it's a bit of a different story. Now we are in a situation that labor market shows sign of, still shows some sign of softness here and there. But overall, it's for this point of the business cycle is a very strong labor market. Growth is steady. Last year, we're still waiting for the final number in US, but the growth exceeded the expectation and it was above the trend growth rate for the second or the third year, basically post-COVID. So this is the macro picture. In contrast, what we have seen in just to give an example, in Europe, the inflation came down quite fast to the level that central bank feels comfortable. The rate cut had more dovish tone into them compared to the US, that even the market was expecting that these are going to be a couple of rate cuts and then the pause. In Europe, the case is a little bit different. The labor market never recovered to the level that we have seen in the US market. And now we are in a situation that some of the kind of political, unexpected political volatility that we saw during the summer in Europe as well contributed to the softness of the labor market and also softness of the economy in general in Europe.
If we compare and contrast those two markets over the course of 2024 compared to what we can sort of back out of the interest rate curves at the start, is it fair for me to say that as of sort of January 1, 2024, markets were expecting quite steep cuts in rates in both the US and Europe? In both cases, the rate cuts came, but they were a bit later than expected. But the big difference now is that the US is basically not expected to keep cutting rates much at all, being at a much higher level than markets were expecting, whereas Europe is basically expected to keep cutting more or less to where markets thought it was going to get to about a year ago.
Yeah, I agree with that conclusion. That's a certain very putting of what has happened in the front end of the term in terms of policy rate. And I think going forward, the divergence between the policies can become even stronger. Just to put some of the features in the perspective, if you look at the market, usually to compare the rates, the not just the front end of the curve, but the financing rate that is matter for the companies, usually around 10-year area of the curve. If you look at the spread between U.S. Treasury and bonds 10-year, the spread is widest at the widest level. This level of the spread widening is, as we would see them in a situation that one side of this equation is really deep into crisis. But we know it's not that. It's a pull and push. Europe has faced some softening, unexpected volatility due to the policy risk. U.S. has faced some kind of like the other side of has faced more upside in terms of the level of the risk premium. And that's also because of the policy risk, but completely a different kind of direction, if we want to think about it. I wanted to kind of highlight a little bit looking forward. You mentioned China. I think this is a hot topic at the moment that everybody looks at the long end of the curve and kind of flags that now the 30-year China is below JGB's Japanese curve. That's quite significant. We know what was keeping the GB curves quite flat and below other curves. There is a long-term chronicle disinflation, deflationary pressure in the economy. Now we see that China is heading that direction. It's a little bit different. I don't think that we need to kind of call it the end of the game and say that this is a viral spiral that pulls the China into a deflationary state. And this is the same kind of China is following the Japan's book. It's a different type of economy, different level of technology. And also, I think demography is a very big factor that plays can potentially put them on different path. But it's inevitable to think that in such circumstances, given the implementation of an unprecedented policy in summer, in terms of both size and magnitude and also sequencing that they had, was very non-Chinese type of policy that they implemented. So now it's right that market is questioning how far and how deep they can shake the market to take the economy out of this pattern and trend.
It's a pretty amazing sort of observation, right? I wish at the start of our 2024 trends, we had said that we had expected Japanese and Chinese long rates to cross. We probably would have got pretty good odds on that. Unfortunately, we didn't, but it happened over the course of the last year. With all these big changes in interest rates going on, that must have some pretty strong implications for currencies as well as for other asset classes like volatility, doesn't it?
Certainly. If we want to, because we are trying it for our audience, we are not in the business of forecasting the market. So if anything, we are trying to emphasize on the trends that is observed or we think that is important for our investors to observe. One of the features potentially going into 2025 is that when we were talking about it earlier, if you look at the different element, fundamental element of the economy in US specifically, labor market is a strong, with some softening, some bucket of softening. The growth, the drivers of the growth seems to be stable in terms of the macro economy, micro level of economy and corporate outputs, corporate profitability. But what we have is the policy uncertainty that can go very deep. It reaches all aspects of the US economy from bottom up. Its impact on policies that they're going to be implemented on immigration policies, the negotiation over the trade rights, and all of kind of the policies that defines the new administration has deep impact. So going forward, it's very hard. I dare to say that the market has maybe jumped over itself, jumped overhead and tried to kind of price in all of these policies in one go. It's natural to have a little bit of a jitter before kind of it becomes very clear what's going to happen. But some of these policies can take some time. So bottom line is that we might have a view that the terminal point of these policies, where is it, what they are aiming to do, but how they are implemented can have a vastly different impact. I want to give just one highlight. If the tariff negotiations are for US to make sure that the partners that they have large negative balance with US, improving that balance is very pro-growth for US economy and globally has a positive impact, specifically on Europe and that region. If this tariffs negotiation turns into trade war and it's reciprocated by large trading partners, that's really negative for growth and can impact macroeconomy.
Normally, we think of the fixed income markets as sort of the main sort of places to look for clues and hints as to policy, but because of this interesting sort of feature of the incoming administration's policies around tariffs, I just wondered, Demetris, if we've got any insights that we can draw from equity markets to help us make sense of ways in which tariff changes might sort of reverberate around global financial markets.
Yes, there are some interesting indications from equity markets. Investors can look at where companies generate their revenues. Obviously, there are companies that are much more exposed to the international, the global economy. Other companies generate most of their revenues at home. I think it's also interesting when the observation I made earlier, which is obviously most of our listeners would be familiar with, regarding the high valuations in the US and relatively lower valuations in international markets, emerging markets. One step further from that is to take into account earnings growth and growth expectations in particular. So actually, once you adjust for just 12 months forward, 1 year forward earnings growth expectations, that gap in valuations becomes, it's still there, but it's less pronounced. So still you notice, especially that US large cap or mega cap companies, even once you adjust for their superior earnings growth. They've been delivering superior earnings and they are expected to continue to do that, at least in the near term. So they still trade at a so-called PEG ratio, PE to growth, right? You can divide the PE ratio with growth expectations. So the PEG ratio for mega caps is still higher in the US. But actually, when you adjust for growth expectations, the gap with international markets is much smaller. And in fact, the mid-cap and small-cap segments in the US start to look relatively attractive on it, once you adjust the valuations with growth expectations.
That's really fascinating, that sort of ability that we have to try to control for growth expectations. I think it's really perhaps something that, as far as I'm concerned, we don't see enough of in public discussion because... we know, as you highlighted earlier, that US companies are very richly valued on current earnings, but we also know that there's big expectations for future growth. And at least 1 year out, expectations for future growth are pretty informative about what's actually going to happen, right? So finding some way like this PEG ratio to control for that seems like a really helpful analytical tool.
Absolutely. I think a lot of equity market investors, our listeners, are probably looking beyond the headline numbers. And just, again, if I could make some comments regarding 2024, for the U.S. equity market, headline number performance 24%. And I've already mentioned that half of that comes from multiple expansion, right? When you have your P/E ratio at the beginning of the year at 25 and it's now 28, obviously that's about a 12% increase in the multiple. And, you know, simple math says that half of the performance of 2024 can be accounted by or can be attributed to this multiple expansion. But clearly the other half is earnings growth. And then if we go a little bit beyond earnings growth numbers and we look at top line growth, sales growth versus margin expansion, it's actually the margin expansion that's about two thirds of the remaining 12%. So half of the performance comes from multiple expansion. The other half is earnings growth. But then when you dig a little bit deeper, you realize that it's less of that is top line growth and most of it is margin expansion. So I guess the big conundrum, the big question for equity market investors in 2025 is how much of that can be repeated? And, you know, can our multiples continue to expand? Can the top line, you know, sales growth be of the order of 3 or 4%? And can companies achieve the same margin expansion? And we mentioned in our investment trends paper that there is an AI arms race going on. And I think just to mix my metaphors, we could call it a gold rush. So obviously there, you know, you have to think about in a gold rush, who is digging for gold, but also who is providing the equipment or selling the shovels to dig for growth. And in this case, one of the big questions for equity investors is this high capex required to participate in this AI arms race, to what extent it will impact the earnings of companies in the technology sector and other sectors.
Actually, I want to kind of take the end of the point and at one point about the valuation going forward. It's more than valuation, is looking at the earning possibility and what's happening fundamentally at the macro level.
When we started with the cycle, this
interest rate cycle at the beginning of 2022 and then into 2023, the companies were coming just out of COVID. They have repositioned, they have improved their balance sheet, and they were in a better and healthier, stronger situation. Now that if there is a chance that we are going to go through an environment that basically the the next move of the Fed is hike rather than cut, because the reason, a group of the reasons that we mentioned. I think there is a some vulnerability at different layers of the economy and their sensitivity to interest rate. Put it precisely, I think we first round of increasing interest rates, the companies had a strong balance sheet position because they did not necessarily need to raise new fundings. This round around, we are facing the situation that the companies have to roll. Most of the corporate's borrowing is 5 to 7 years, and in high yield, usually around 3 to 5 years. So thinking about that, 2025, 2026, we are going through the round of kind of refinancing and the change in the cost of funding, given the current level of the rate from the previous level of the rate, almost double or triple, doubled twice larger or two, not three times for a lot of them. But this is going to impact fundamental of the companies. And I think we have started to see that already. Number of, if you look at the weekly number of the bankruptcy filing for the smaller businesses or the stress level that we see in private market, these are signs to watch.
Obviously, the sort of bankruptcy filings for businesses are publicly observable. But distress levels in private markets typically are not. Those markets are quite opaque. Fortunately, we at MSCI actually have some of the leading data on the state of those markets. So since the conversation has taken us this way, Keith, can you jump in and give us a bit of a snapshot into both the mechanics of private credit markets and whether we're likely to see kind of, for instance, a conventional wave of defaults in those markets? And second, what sort of evidence we see around at least distress in private credit?
So, I mean, private credit is, you can't talk about private assets without talking about private credit front and center as being probably the fastest growing part of the space. And these are interesting vehicles, right? Because these are funds making loans to companies and properties and kind of other against other assets where traditional lenders have pulled back. And they're interesting in their opacity, but we do have a pretty wide view as to what's going on in these private credit funds. And we've done some research. There is hints of rising stress and distress in kind of those vehicles where. The current valuation of the loans is meaningfully lower than the par value of that loan. Now, these are private credit funds, so they mechanically can work very differently. These are very kind of bilateral deals. It's not a broad syndicate that's often involved here. And so there's often the ability of the private credit lender to restructure and to work with the company. So where default events are... may not look the same as they would in public markets. That isn't to say that there aren't kind of real default events. Financial Times had a piece in the past week about Alacrity, so a pretty large investment they had made, or BlackRock had made rather, through one of its longer term vehicles, and it's now under the control of the private credit lenders, and it's probably one of the larger, more notable distress events or restructuring events to have happened recently. So private credit funds are weird. They're opaque, but there's definitely some signs of distress.
So can I just, for the benefit of some of our listeners, in general, before private credit came to be a big thing, you would, if you're a large company, for instance, you might either issue some bonds, in which case you would have lots and lots of different holders of the bonds, or you might borrow from the bank, but then the bank would take that loan and kind of carve it up amongst a whole lot of different institutions. And what happened then would be, if you couldn't afford to pay, there was no one person with whom you could negotiate, and so you just had to fail to make your payment to any of them. And that's what people are talking about when they're talking about a default, right? And I guess your point, Keith, it's fair to say, is that in private credit, well, it's just like, I've come to you and said, hey, Keith, can I have $100? And if next month I can't pay you back, you might say, well, look, that's okay. Just give me a piece of paper saying you'll give me $100 next month, and I won't say you've defaulted. Is that kind of how it can work sometimes?
In a very basic sense, yes. I'd say private credit has two features to it that companies like. There's certainty of execution. These funds can underwrite deals very quickly. And then there is the flexibility. So if the company does get into some type of trouble, it is a very small, sometimes single lender that they are having these conversations with, and they can change to a paid in kind note for some time, or they can kind of other arrangements, you know, loosen the covenants to avoid a default. There's even some interesting academic research written by Young Su that suggests that companies which receive debt from private lenders are actually less likely to go bankrupt, all else being equal. And there's suggestions that they are actually constructive, positive partners. So it's no surprise that private credit is becoming very popular with firms.
So it's very nice of you to let me just give you that IOU instead of $100, right? So thank you. So how do we figure out then if there is distress, if we don't actually register that there's a default?
And as I mentioned earlier, we track a lot of quarterly information about the loans on a recurring basis. And so we can see situations where the kind of the current value, and you know, these are somewhat illiquid investments, but there are still accounting rules that exist within private markets. And so you can see situations where the securities have been written down relative to their par value. But we can also observe situations where the terms of the note seem to have changed when you otherwise would not expect it. And we see the financial statements, and I will say the financial statements aren't always the most clear as to what happened. And I guess you could interpret that different ways, but we do see situations where kind of the interest rate has changed from one quarter to the next, and there's kind of some implied restructuring event that's taken place. This is a data set that we're pretty actively building out, and I think we'll definitely be looking to, you know, kind of continue our research in here over the next year.
And so on the stuff that's been written down below par, as you put it, that means, again, for the benefit of some of our listeners, I come to you and say, well, I can't pay you the $100 this month. Can I pay it later? You have to start saying, well, maybe it's not worth $100 to me anymore. It's only worth $80 because maybe actually won't pay me. Is there much of that going on compared to, say, the good days when interest rates were low?
There is some of that. You are seeing situations where there's loans that are getting marked down. But on the whole, private credit returns have been good. And so the takeaway there is that, yes, there are stress in some parts of the, some borrowers are getting into a little bit of trouble, the early days of trouble, but the returns on the rest of the book have been good enough that the private credit returns as a whole are still positive. It's actually been one of the best performing asset classes over the past few years, not necessarily because it has the highest absolute returns, but it has great relative returns. There's been very few quarters where private credit funds in aggregate have seen write-downs.
Let's see what 2025 holds for private credit. I want to go right back to some of our earlier discussion about developments in the Chinese economy. Obviously, there's a lot of doom and gloom around about the fate of the Chinese stimulus, the tendency for Chinese interest rates to fall. But I think it's important to remember just how important China and indeed Asia as a whole is in the world economy today. These are not the developing markets sort of 15 or 20 years ago. Some of our sustainability researchers have got some particularly sort of graphic evidence of how important Asia is to the physical world of production as opposed to the financial world of assets. Sinsen, can you talk us through some of that research, please?
Absolutely. As you mentioned that Asia and including China cannot be ignored in the current economy, especially with their dominance in the energy consumption. As we pointed out in our research, that Asia's energy consumption is actually nearing that of the rest of the world combined. And over the last decade, Asia has increased consumption of all major energy sources, while the rest of the world's energy consumption has remained flat. So that's how important and for the investors to consider when we look at the sustainable future that we are heading into.
I guess in some ways that reflects like Asia's status and China's status in particular, maybe as like the factory of the world, right?
Absolutely. As you look at I think my colleagues pointed out earlier, if you look at the major trading partner of the U.S., Asia, China are definitely, you know, some of the top on the list over there. So they are the factory of the world. And as a result, their role in energy transition has been significant. China in particular is a major contributor to Asia's increased energy consumption and is making significant investment in renewable energy like solar and wind power in the recent years, as well as increasing its use of natural gas. So whether Asia or especially China replace coal with gas and renewable or adds more of everything to meet their rising demand, that can be a major factor in the energy transition's trajectory.
And so, for example, while the bulk of the world's financial assets, measured by market cap at least, reside within the US, because of this kind of factory of the world status, and particularly when you look at energy mix, you know, the incoming US administration can be climate skeptics or not, but much of the world's fossil fuel use is really dominated, is it not, by the Asian economies that we're talking about. And that imply then that really some of the most important determinants of just how much climate change actually ends up happening is going to come out of Asia.
Absolutely. Asia's energy consumption is massive and growing. It's on track to rival the rest of the world combined. What happens there really sets the tone for global climate outcomes. Take China, for example. It's leading the charge in renewable energy and absolutely dominating in electric vehicles. Chinese companies are selling more EVs than anyone else outside the US, and they're closing that gap fast. That's reshaping the global auto market and even sparking trade tensions like tariffs from the US and Europe. And it's not just China. Countries like India and Korea are huge players too. They are tied into global energy and manufacturing supply chains. So any shifts in trade policies or tariffs could ripple across the world. The new US administration, for instance, is already shaking things up with its stance on tariffs, which could make these supply chains more fragmented and the energy transition more expensive. And the big question here is how quickly Asia, especially China, can move away from coal and scale up renewables. That's going to be a game changer for the planet. If they get it right, it could put us on a better path for managing climate change. But if not, the stakes are high for everyone. There's definitely a lot of uncertainties.
Ashley, if I can maybe jump in, add a quick comment on tariffs and the risk of tariffs and how that's reflected in our equity risk model. It's actually quite interesting if you look at the economic exposure factor in our emerging markets model. This had a sharp drawdown in the last quarter of 2024, as it became evident that obviously the new U.S. administration increases the risk of imposing new tariffs. And this is quite an interesting way to quantify. It's a proxy for tariff risk, if you want, because the economic exposure factor is essentially capturing the performance of smaller emerging market exporters. And they have suffered in the last quarter of 2024, as we have seen these developments in terms of the new U.S. administration.
That's very interesting, because in some ways what happened last time around with the Trump administration, was it not, was that as kind of the administration discouraged trade with China, there was some trade displacement effect towards some of these sort of smaller emerging market economies. And we saw pretty good stock market performance from some of those, such as Mexico and so on. You're saying that with the tone of the new administration being quite negative on sort of a much broader set of EM economies, maybe these economies that were beneficiaries last time around might stand to lose this time.
That's right. And looking at this economic exposure factor is quite an elegant way to quantify that, because as part of the estimation process of our risk models, you hedge out all the country and sector effects and you get the pure effect of economic exposure. But even looking at headline market performance, of course, throughout 2024, some of the Latin American markets were some of the worst performing emerging markets, Mexico, Brazil, partly because of currency effects, but also very much because of equity market. So both the headline numbers as well as some of our factor performance numbers tend to point to the same effect.
And this idea may be new to some listeners, that you can actually look at sort of finer grained measures of what's going on in markets rather than purely relying on country indexes as a way of thinking about who's exposed to what risk.
That's right. And I think investors can, obviously looking at different perspectives, different levels of granularity, can get the full picture in a much more vivid way.
Thank you, Dimitris. Coming back to you, Simpson, I want to pick up on one of the things you said about China exporting electric vehicles now. This is in some ways a repeating or recurring pattern throughout the history of Asian economic development, where Asian countries are sort of seen as producing sort of inferior import substituting only quantities, manufactured goods at first, but then turn to exporting. How's that exporting story look at the moment for electric vehicles from China?
China's EV story is actually quite remarkable. The country actually began investing heavily in its EV industry in the early 2000s, long before climate targets become a central theme in global discussions. Initially, production was focused on meeting domestic demand, and there has been more policy support with President Xi Jinping's climate commitments, including achieving carbon neutrality by 2060. To support these goals, the government implemented robust policies and fiscal incentives to stimulate key industries, with EVs being a major beneficiary. In recent years, the industry growth has actually outpaced domestic demand. Chinese manufacturers have ramped up production and began exporting EVs. They are now making significant global sales, particularly in Asia and Europe, and also in the US. What's striking is how quickly Chinese companies are closing the gap with the US, which has traditionally been dominant in the space. That said, the growth hasn't come without challenges. The US and Europe have responded with policies like tariffs and stricter trade rules designed to limit Chinese EV imports, creating geopolitical tensions. This is adding volatility and uncertainty to the market, as my colleague Afsani pointed out earlier. Still, China's rise in the EV exports is a key part of its broader energy transition story, and it's definitely reshaping the global auto industry.
Now, of course, if the US decides to put on some tariffs, this EV capacity in China isn't going to suddenly magically disappear overnight, is it? So the Chinese are going to look to export their electric vehicles even more aggressively to other parts of the world.
Yes, and Asia in particular is one example.
I guess the other interesting sort of feature of this aspect of tariffs and potential trade wars is that not only is China very technologically sophisticated in terms of its production of electric vehicles, but also, as we've commented before on this podcast, they also happen to hold an upper hand in the supply of a lot of the raw materials that are necessary for electrification.
Absolutely. China, as you mentioned, got a huge upper hand when it comes to the raw materials that are essential for electrification, like lithium, cobalt, and rare earth elements. These resources are critical for batteries, motors, and other EV components, and China has built a tight grip on both mining and processing. Now, here's where things get really interesting. If the US or Europe ramps up tariffs on Chinese EVs, they're not just blocking cars. They are potentially creating a whole new set of challenges for their own supply chains. To build EVs domestically as a replacement, they still need those same raw materials that China dominates. And if China were to retaliate by restricting access to these materials, it could cause major disruptions, driving up costs and slowing the pace of electrification in the world. This dynamic creates a lot of uncertainty and potential tensions. But at the same time, it's a reminder of how interconnected and delicate these supply chains really are. And finding a balance, whether through trade agreements or alternative supply chains, is going to be the key. And let's hope that there will be a solution in sight.
We can certainly hope so, but it does seem unlikely that the rest of the world, and certainly a very serious power like China, is going to sit there like a rabbit in the headlights, isn't it? So let's turn back now to kind of the last chapter of US dominance, which is potentially around private markets. And I'd like to bring you, Keith, back into the conversation. Sort of circling all the way back to some of our AI discussion at the start of today's podcast. Of course, the US, we've noted, is very dominant in market cap public equities. Is the US sort of comparably dominant in private equities? And is there a similar sort of sectoral bias towards technology? Certainly a story which one often hears is that maybe even a causal reason why the US is so far ahead in technologies like AI is because of its vibrant private equity and venture capital in particular ecosystem. Do we have any evidence that can shed light on that?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, in terms of total size, the private asset industry, more than half of all dollars invested are they're in the United States. And that is U.S. companies, not just U.S.-based firms. Within the United States, there is a relative concentration into information technology firms. This is obviously true in venture capital, where almost half of all U.S. VC is in IT investments, and that is meaningfully higher than venture capital around the rest of the world, which is a little bit more kind of consumer and other sector focused. But it's also true within buyouts. Now, it's less pronounced, but U.S. buyout firms tend to be more invested into IT companies than their global counterparts. And this basic concentration exists, I think, as we've mentioned, in listed markets as well, right? The U.S. has doubled the IT exposure as the rest of the world. And when you look at performance and longer time horizons, it's certainly within private assets, the IT investments have done well. And so the U.S. private markets have outperformed the rest of the world by, I think it's about 1% annually. If you look at long time horizons, right, we're talking 10-year annualized returns. And I think a lot of that is driven by the relative IT focus. IT has done well in privates, and the U.S. holds more of it.
It's been an interesting couple of years. We've talked about the implications of rate rises that we've seen so far in private credit. It's been an interesting two or three years also in private equity, perhaps tied to the rate rises. Can you talk us through what's been happening there, especially in terms of valuations and in terms of investors getting their money back from the private equity asset managers?
I mean, the story in privates since the end of 2021 has been subdued cash flows. And that is both capital called from investors into new funds, but also capital distributed back to investors, right? Because remember, the private capital industry, the majority of investments, these are still closed-end drawdown style vehicles. They have finite lives. And so there is a part of the life where capital is called and a part where it's distributed. And it's been relatively slow since 2021. Interestingly, if you look at some of the Q4 data, and this is highly kind of preliminary, but we do get a sense of kind of the most recent quarter. Capital called, so new investments, looks to be, let's call it 50% higher than recent quarters over the past few years. Distributions, maybe 30 to 40% higher. Now, the fourth quarter is always busier in private capital. There's a seasonality, but this is more than the usual seasonality. And so kind of the early indications was that the fourth quarter might have been the most active since the end of 2021. And so kind of seems like the subdued cash flows might be going away. There might be kind of some more investment activity that's going on.
Now, some of that may be due to the new administration, I guess, and some of its policies, although that happened relatively late in the quarter, even the election. So I guess it must also reflect perhaps more favorable public equity market valuations again, perhaps some catch up to where private valuations had previously been. Is there anything else that's in the mix there?
Yeah, it's certainly, I think the exit markets have been improving since the lows. And so you would expect every quarter gets a little bit better. But some of it is also just timing. There's over $2 trillion in dry powder that's committed to these funds and not yet called down. It's about 2.5 years worth of, if you take the quarterly contributions, how much is called down, it's about 2.5 years worth of capital. And there's a lot of large funds that are approaching their third, fourth birthday. In these closed-end funds, you don't have forever to wait. You have the investment period is the first 3 to 5 years of the fund's life. So there is some capital that is dry powder that really has to get called over the next few quarters, at most next few years. So you would expect more activity on that front. But on the other end, you also see there's deals that are kind of stuck, particularly in venture capital. There's over $200 billion that's in venture capital holdings, which are in their eighth investment year or longer. And that is like unheard of if you look back at historical cycles, how long some of these are kind of sitting on the books of these funds. And again, these are closed-end finite life vehicles that, investors do expect their money back. And so I think there's growing pressure on asset managers to kind of to start calling down capital to make new investments, the committed capital, but to also figure out and start realizing some of these existing deals.
So I guess lots of pressure to actually sell, lots of pressure to do deals, quite a lot of expectation that there will be a more friendly regulatory environment. So it seems like, a crash or external factors kind of excluded, 2025 should be a year that's full of activity in private markets, much more than we've seen in recent years.
Yes, and it looks like the fourth quarter looks like it was it's a strong close to the year. So definitely eagerly await data as it comes in to see if that momentum has continued.
I've got at least another 100 questions that I'd like to ask all of you, but unfortunately, I think we're right out of time. So thank you first so much to Demetris, Afsane, Keith, and Sinsin for joining us. And an even bigger thank you again to you, our listeners. We'll be back to discuss the first quarter's events in April. And until then, this is Ashley Lester wishing you success in your investments in 2025.
That's all for this week. Our thanks to Ashley, Demetris, Afsane, Keith, and Sinsin, and to all of you for listening. For more on the key themes to watch in 2025, as well as additional insights from Ashley and team, visit the In Focus page on MSCI.com. Next up on the program, many expect that the incoming U.S. administration will be much more welcoming when it comes to digital assets and different ways of investing in them. We've all heard of Bitcoin, of course, but we'll dig deeper to mine the story in full. Until then, I'm your host, Adam Bass, and this is MSCI Perspectives.